Welcome to the Learning Reinvented podcast, brought to you by myself, James Politilo, and the team at The Learning Effect. There are lots of learning podcasts out there, so we wanted to do something slightly different. In this episode, we will be discussing neurodiversity, and I am delighted to welcome Hayley Brackley to the podcast to share her knowledge and expertise. Welcome, Hayley.
Hi, James. Thanks so much for having me here.
I really appreciate you taking your time out today to join us and share your expertise. Do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. Thanks so much. So as you very kindly introduced me, my name's Hayley Brackley and I specialise in neurodiversity. My background comes from learning and development and I'm also trained as a coach as well. I am neurodivergent myself. So what I mean by that is I have a brain that works in a way that is different from the majority of people's. And specifically, I have ADHD, autism and dyslexia. And so I bring together the background of L&D, the being a coach, and then also the kind of lived experience and years of research into neurodiversity and neurodivergence, looking at how different people's brains work differently to kind of marry the two together, support organisations and individuals to just have their best day at work.
That's great. And you've touched upon a tiny bit about what neurodiversity might be. And I'm sure all of our listeners will have heard of neurodiversity, but there will be huge amounts of disparity in people's level of knowledge, awareness, personal experience, etc., etc. So do you want to sort of dive more into that and tell us more about what neurodiversity is and maybe share a bit more about your journey?
Yes, absolutely. So I'll start off with neurodiversity and then I'll try to remember that I was coming back to talk about my journey, and you can obviously remind me if I forget. So neurodiversity as a whole is about how all of us as a group of species, as a human race, how we have brains that work in different ways. It's a fabulous term coined by a wonderful lady called Judy Singer, who is an Australian sociologist, and back in the late 90s, she came up with the term to really sum up the fact that all of us have a brain that works in a different way. And I think that's really important to remember. You know, this is not just about saying, oh, this one person works differently, so we just need to focus on that. Actually, all of us, you know, like some people like corned beef sandwiches. I'm not quite sure why, but I'm told that some people like corned beef sandwiches. Some people like bananas on toast. Some people will only have peanut butter. And that's just one way in which we are different. And we accept that about people, right? But what we sometimes don't necessarily get is the ways that we're different when it comes down to communication differences or sensory experience differences, concentration differences, even things like the way that we read, the way that we write, the way that we use our body as a whole. And all of those things contribute to this idea of just neurodiversity, the way that we all work differently. And so over the last 20 years or so, what we've seen is the neurodiversity movement. And what that's highlighted is that there is this need to be more inclusive, to understand more about neurodiversity and neurodivergence. So neurodivergence is a word that really encapsulates the sort of roughly 20% of people whose brains work in a way that is different as such that we can categorize it under conditions or differences like ADHD, autism, dyslexia, dyspraxia, dysgraphia, dyscalculia, Tourette's, and so on. And so that's our neurodivergence. And this movement has said, you know what, for a really long time, academia and the clinical world have owned that space. And so everything has been a deficit model. Everything's about what people can't do. And what this movement has said is, actually, let's claim that back. Let's have people with lived experience sharing stories, talking about how this works. And let's focus on the strengths. Let's not make this all about a deficit model. Let's look at what works really, really well for people. And let's not be, there's a word called neuronormative. And it means basically treating the normal. And for those that can't see me, I'm putting the inverted commas around normal there because it's just an awful word. But the normal way of doing something as the neurotypical, so the 80% of people, treating that as the right way to be and that trying to get everybody else to conform to that difference. And actually, that's not going to help us. That's not going to help us as individuals to be the best that we can. But it's also not going to help us as a society, as a group, as a workplace, even as a community, because it's the diversity in us that makes us fabulous, right? If we're all this cookie cutter mold of the same person, well, imagine if you had 5,000 Homer Simpsons. The world is probably not big enough for 5,000 Homer Simpsons. But if we can have one Homer Simpson, one Bart Simpson, one Maggie and one Marge, actually that's going to make for a much better place for us all to be. So that's a little bit more about neurodiversity. And then you asked me about myself. So I was diagnosed with ADHD and dyslexia back in the early 2000s, so we're looking 21 years ago now, and I was a teenager at the time, and it was something that really wasn't well understood. I was the first girl that my psychiatrist had ever diagnosed, and it just wasn't something that we knew much about. And so growing up, the people around me, teachers, adults, nobody really knew where to put me, because, you know, I was somebody whose brain was different, but not in a way that meant that I couldn't write my own name, or that, you know, I had a really low intellect, which was really all that was understood about learning differences, was about the level of intellect. And ironically, in the same month that I received my ADHD diagnosis, I also received an acceptance letter to Mensa, which is the organisation for the top 2% of IQ points. And so, you know, this massive kind of contrast between, okay, so she's got dyslexia and that means that she won't know how to write, right? Is that right? But also she's really, really bright and she knows probably more stuff and can work things out quicker than perhaps anybody else that we know. So what do we do with that? And that literally was how I felt. Like, what do we do with this being? So I carried on. I took medication, which again was something really, really new, wasn't something that was commonplace at all. And I got through the end of my school years. I somehow, thanks to some very wonderful, very patient teachers and medication, received some GCSEs and some really good GCSEs, actually, which surprised everybody, most of all me. And so I went into the world of work. I had a job process and housing benefit, which, if you ever fancy a career change and want to do something that's really quite boring, I recommend process and housing benefit. It really wasn't for me. It didn't fit to my strengths at all. And I had to really mould myself into this way of being. And I get in trouble quite a lot for doing things like hiding earphones under my ears, just trying to reduce some of the distraction, make the day a bit more interesting. I always had the lowest productivity, but the highest number of chats with people. I'm not sure that that's a great ethos for a workplace necessarily. However, what did happen was I then discovered, I had a long career in the fire service, and in there discovered the world of L&D and was like, this is amazing. It's you're not targeted on productivity and you get to have loads of chats with people. You know, what more is there to life than the world of L&D? And so I discovered that training was something that came really easily to me. It was something that I really enjoyed and actually was pretty good at. It really fitted to my strengths. I discovered that coaching, you know, being able to see things perhaps from a different perspective and create the space for somebody else to have a conversation around that, that was brilliant. I was like, this is wonderful. This is like my happiest place to be. And then I should probably add in, unfortunately, prior to finding the wonderful world of L&D, I did work for somebody that was not particularly inclusive and had a pretty rough time working there, to the extent that unfortunately I did have a mental breakdown. And it was coming out the back of that that helped me to see things in a different way. And so when I had the opportunity to go freelance, work for myself, run a business, and I really thought about, everybody said you should niche. And I was like, I'm not going to niche. And then all of a sudden I found myself in a fabulous niche where all I talk about most of the time is neurodiversity, learning and coaching, and really bringing together the facilitation of helping people to understand what neurodiversity is, helping people to understand how to create really inclusive environments to be able to get the best out of themselves and each other in a workplace. And also helping individuals to understand, you know, because if you've grown up as the 20% in a world that was designed for the 80%, there's a strong chance that you might need somebody to kind of help you through navigating that 20% world and seeing things a little bit more, a little bit differently. And one of the things that comes up so often is things like self-confidence, self-esteem, self-belief. But actually, if I were to kind of think of a theme, that's the most common one that I work with. It's not about how do I concentrate more, or how do I communicate differently, or how do I remember things better. Those things come up, right? I'm not saying they never do. But overall, that self-confidence, that self-esteem, that's the thing that comes up most. And I guess that's why I really stand by what I do, and why to me it means so much, is because actually this is real humans. This is not, you know, we're not talking about Lego characters, we're not talking about The Simpsons. This is actual people. This is like you and me, James, and people deserve to have a really great day at work. They deserve to have a job that gets the best out of them, and they get the best out of it. And you know, if we can do something that helps facilitate that, then marvelous.
I think, you know, you've gone through so much there, Hayley, so really appreciate you sort of unpacking that, sharing your story and that journey. But, you know, there's things you talked about there. And I think just going back to that being part of the 20%, and you talked about the cookie cutter approach. And I know at the beginning of my career, there was very little sort of diversity of thought in anything. You know, we're coming out of the back of that more traditional post-war, you know, workplace that had just decided this was the way you did things, and there was no real adaptation for anyone. Or again, you know, I was the class clown at school because I didn't quite fit in, it didn't work for me. And there were a set of places where you had to conform and you had to approach things. And I spent my entire school time saying, when can I actually have a decision of my own? When can I stop quoting other people? When can I start doing different things? It just made no sense to me. And I think all of us, as you said, we all think differently. We all, you know, come at things from different perspectives. And I think that's a really helpful way to position it, because we, at times, regardless of whether we're categorized in the 20% or the 80%, there will be times we all feel that we don't quite fit, or what we're doing isn't quite valued, or we're having to work extra hard. And it's about that conversation to me is, how do we bring that to the fore? Because I've come across a lot of people who just want to categorize someone into a box, and where you said you didn't quite fit in the box, you know, like your Mensa at the same point as you're getting an ADHD diagnosis, those things to people who aren't going to take the time to try to understand or explore can feel very, I don't know, just like it doesn't make sense. And people won't always take the time to understand. They'll just want the quick, easy, can I put them in a box? Can I categorize them? Can I tick a few bits or do a few things to make this work? And I think that richness of complexity that you talked about is really, really important.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think one of the things that I am really believe really strongly in is, it's not demonizing the putting people in a box, right? And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that means that we should do it, but as humans, we like to understand things. We like to make things clear. We like to be able to go, right, so that works like that, and that works like that. And we can do that with cars. You know, there's this model of car that does that, and this model of car that does that, and they're designed in that way, and that works brilliantly. And we can do it with colours. You know, you might have seen a colour wheel, and the colour wheel says go opposite or do a little triangle to be able to work out which colours go together in perfect synchronicity. And that works splendidly. And to some extent we do it with ingredients, you know, we'll say that you should have the mix of some sweet and some savory and bring these things together, and we can put those sorts of things in boxes. But humans, we're just not box material, unfortunately. You know, like there is that complexity. You said the richness of complexity, and you're absolutely right. It is such a rich complexity. And I think if we make people feel bad about trying to put people in boxes, we might run the risk of turning them off to the conversation. So what I want to do is make sure that nobody feels like we're making them feel bad, because that's such a normal part of human existence, to try and understand things by putting them into a box. And this is where the and comes in. And it's not going to fit into a box. Not but, and. And so it really is one of those areas where there are so many shades of not just grey, but, you know, all of the colours, so many shades of all of the colours. And that's why there's not going to be a cookie cutter approach. I'm not going to come on and I'm going to be like, James, I'm going to tell your listeners, I'm going to tell them exactly how to deliver training that's going to be perfect for somebody with ADHD. And then if they add this bit in, then that would also make it perfect for somebody that's dyslexic. It's not one of those beautiful flow charts where, you know, you answer the yes, no questions and then it tells you exactly what to do. It's about the environment, the culture. It's about the support. It's about the thinking things through. It's about the understanding. It's about the inviting people to clarify and to question. And this is not just for a training environment, right? This is for life. This is for everything. It's also about my experience is not your experience. My preference is not your preference. My way of being is not your way of being. And so let's go back to the corned beef sandwiches. I don't go around telling people that they're wrong because they've got a corned beef sandwich. I don't try and tell people that they need to not eat them. And similarly, people don't tend to try and tell me that I should eat them. We just accept that there's differences here. And some people are going to love being surrounded by a big group of people. And some people are not. Some people are going to prefer to communicate in writing. And some people are going to prefer to have a little bit of a chat. And some people are going to like to stand up on a stage and deliver something. And some people could not think of anything worse. And it's a tapestry, isn't it? You don't just have, I mean, imagine if you created a tapestry with one colour of thread.
It'd be dull as ditch water.
Wouldn't it just? We need the variety. We need things to not fit perfectly into boxes, because that's what makes us humans.
And people are pushing for diversity of thought, diversity of background, diversity of experience, all of those things now within work. And, you know, you've talked about playing to your strengths, and, you know, we've had strengths-based coaching and models around for a good while. But I think it is that, as you said, everyone deserves that happy day at work, that day where they feel they're able to perform as well as they possibly can, and that the environment is working for them. You know, and those are things that we should all be striving for. And there's an element of how you bridge some of those things. And because, as you said, humans do like to think about things in categories and boxes, and that may be your starting point for understanding something. You start to understand what some of those boxes look like, and then you realize, well, that box is not got solid walls and it's a bit squiggly, and, you know, that box merges into that box. But your starting point might be thinking, I've got some nice square, you know, formed boxes, and then your next stage is realizing there is some ambiguity around the edges, etc. So how should people explore that with people? How should people share their preferences? How should people try to understand and include people? Because that's often a really sticky area where, you know, people feel they can't ask. Should they ask? Are they being intrusive? Should people share? You know, and I think that's a really interesting area to explore, because I see lots of different views as to how you should approach those things.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's like anything, you know, some people will tell you that they're on medication for something, and some people absolutely will not, and it's just the same. So what we don't want to do is go having this blanket approach of everybody should disclose like this, because it's not going to work. Now, none of us are entitled to mandate somebody else's disclosure. That's a given. I guess there's an absolute tiny caveat to that, which is if there was something where you believed that the way your brain works could create a dangerous situation, you know, let's get into the Health and Safety at Work Act, there's probably going to be a need for you to disclose that to somebody in an appropriate manner. Other than that, and I mean, like, that's so nuanced and so sort of small. So that's my one caveat. Other than that, actually, nobody should have to make a disclosure. We can't force people. We can't mandate it. And actually, the other thing is that you're only neurotypical being that 80%, you're only neurotypical until the point that you find out that you're neurodivergent. And so if we think about that, actually, if we get too hung up on getting people to disclose and doing things in response to people disclosing, well, we miss out on those people that don't know yet. And unfortunately, the world that we're in, there's an awful lot of people that don't know yet. I read a statistic about it, which I always think is really ironic, that there's a statistic of the number of people that don't know that they're neurodivergent. Because if they don't know, how have we come about a statistic? So I'm not going to share the statistics. I'm a little bit not quite so sure on that. But let me tell you, it was pretty high. And actually, I can believe that. And if we think about the number of people that are now being diagnosed in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, even 70s. I spoke to somebody a little while ago that was diagnosed in their 70s. We know that, you know, that lady in her 70s for 60 years, she didn't know. Well, for 70 years, she didn't know. But for 60 years, she was old enough to maybe have some awareness of her differences and didn't know where that fitted in. So my first point is, we're not going to mandate disclosure, and we're also not going to only operate in a response manner. We don't want to make it so that, oh, well, we've got Hayley today and Hayley's told us that she has ADHD, so we must do this differently. You know, that's not how this is going to work. What we want to do is we want to go from a point of view of, how can I help you to have your best day at work? Or if we're in a learning environment, how can I help you to have your best day in training? And as facilitators, you know, in a learning environment, letting people know, I'm here to help you have the best day. If there's anything I can do that's going to help that, then that's absolutely what I'll do. The flip side is, if we want to disclose to people, then knowing that not everybody's going to have full understanding, and so we might need to give a little bit of information, we might need to clarify, we might need to just let that person know what that means and be able to find a way to articulate for ourselves, you know, this is who I am and this is my identity and this means that, and just communicate that across. And then the other thing is, when somebody does tell us, so there can be temptations to normalize being different. And so sometimes people might say things like, oh, well, we're all a little bit autistic, or, you know, well, everybody's a bit ADHD, aren't they? We're all on the spectrum somewhere. Other really helpful things like that, which I've never heard anybody say with any malice. However, what it does do is it really diminishes the challenges that a person's had in being neurodivergent. But it's also kind of saying, like, oh, don't worry, we all make mistakes sometimes. It's that same angle of thinking of it, the same attitude towards it, where actually it's not a mistake. Like, it's not a bad thing. It's just, this is who I am. So avoid doing the kind of like, don't worry, that's normal narrative. The other thing is, as much as it's tricky, try to avoid the, oh yes, well, my brother's uncle's friend's cousin also has that and they like to do this, because, you know, if you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. Let it be about the person that's having the conversation with you, and thank them. I think that's one of the really important things, like, thanks so much for sharing this with me, it's really helpful, I really appreciate you taking that time to do so. And then co-create the, where do we go from here? So, you know, now that I know this, is there anything that I can do differently? Is there any, in us working together on this, what could we do that's going to be better for you? Those kinds of questions. And, you know, just be a nice human. Great strategy.
I think there's some real parallels to all sort of difference there and how we handle those in the workplace, whether that's cultural difference, whether that's, you know, neurodivergence, whatever it happens to be. But there is this, and I'm not going to say typically English, but in some way it feels like there's a politeness that goes there that's almost sits behind some of those things you're saying and the behaviors that aren't come from malice. They come from, I'm slightly uncomfortable, but I'm going to try and be polite, and I'm going to try and say, you know, as you're in that case of, well, my mother's brother's friends, whatever, you know, that's trying to say, well, you're not the first person I've met, you know, it's not scary. Yeah. That's where that comes from in people. So there's no malice, as you said, behind it, but there's almost an awkwardness, and it's not being able to be comfortable to have that conversation or explore it in a way that doesn't feel too intrusive or too awkward. And, you know, I think everyone will make mistakes in all situations of picking the wrong word or choosing the one. And if people get too hung up on that as well, sometimes it puts the barriers back up that I'm not going to talk or engage, or I'm not even going to react. You know, you see the people who just go, you told me something, I'm not going to react to that because I have no idea how I'm going to react. So I think there's lots of things that people will face when we're talking about any difference that, you know, I've seen some weird behaviors, and I think that comes from personal awkwardness and the things with inside that person, and trying to break down those barriers with awareness and all sorts of things potentially help. I want to move on now to look at how you support organizations and learning teams. Do you want to share with the listeners a little bit about the work you do?
Yeah, thanks. So I work in a number of ways. Most commonly, I come into an organisation and I support raising awareness, because I think that's the most important place to start. If we don't know about something, we're going to be more awkward about it. We're going to be less accepting. We're going to be less inclusive. Whereas if we've got a bit more of an understanding, actually, that's going to go a bit better. And so I very much encourage that we don't do the kind of let's train our managers on how to manage neurodivergent staff. Well, there's a few issues with that. The first one is, what if your managers are neurodivergent? How's that fitting into the scope? The second one is, say we've got Bob, and Bob doesn't like to communicate verbally. Bob prefers to communicate in writing. Bob is working with Grace. Grace is the opposite. Grace really likes to communicate Bob likes to communicate verbally, Grace likes to communicate in writing. And we've trained Bob's manager, but we've not trained Grace. So Grace has no understanding of why Bob likes to work in the way that Bob works. So Grace is getting really frustrated, thinking, why are you communicating in this way? This is not helpful. Communicate in the way that I tell you to communicate. Now, actually, what we want to do is help everybody to understand and everybody to be able to meet in the middle, to, you know, communicate in ways that works across the board, and to have some strategies where if you have got two people that want to communicate differently, what can you do to bring that together? So that's something that we do. We look at individual conditions under that paradigm of neurodivergence. We look at how to help people have the best day at work. We look a little bit at the law, and I don't get too hung up on it. So we've got the Equality Act, which mandates that we need to be inclusive, but actually let's do it because it's the right thing to do rather than doing it because the law mandates it. And we look at what neurodiversity is overall, you know, all of us having those brains that work in different ways. So that would be a base starting point. Then looking at upskilling people to have conversations, you know, if this is something, like you said, if this is something that you're shying away from, that's not going to help. So how do we help you to have these conversations with a bit more confidence, with a more solution focus to them, to do that co-creating? In terms of learning teams, this is something that I love getting involved in, and it's fantastic. So recently I've been working with an organisation who have a team of operational trainers, and what they wanted to do is make sure that their training is as inclusive as it can be. And it's absolutely fantastic to see that happening, you know, to see people really committing to, not just are we not going to do tick box training, but we're going to do training where we go out of our way to make sure that everybody is getting the best out of this. Everybody is able to come and be themselves and learn what they need to learn. And I just think it's great because, and maybe it shouldn't be great, maybe it should be the norm, but I don't think it is the norm, and I don't think it has been the norm. And I guess that's why it feels so great, because it is a shift, it is something new. And just thinking about the cultures that we create in our learning environments, thinking about the physical environment as well. You know, today we're in, for those that aren't listening immediately, we're in the middle of a heat wave, and the heat does really weird things to people. You know, it dysregulates them in everybody, but even more so in those that are neurodivergent. And that's just one example, thinking about the temperature of a physical training environment, thinking about things like your PowerPoint slides. Have you made them really beautiful with all swirly writing that actually perhaps 10% of your audience population can't understand? Or have you made them pragmatically useful and aesthetically pleasing? Because they can be both. You know, we can avoid the swirls, we can avoid the serifs, the little extra bits that tag onto letters, and we can have nice clear writing, we can have great contrast between the background and the front of the writing, we can have alternative formats for people, we can have some notes that people can take away if they're going to struggle to write the notes in the session. All of these things are just things that are going to help people to get the best out of that training.
I think you touched upon there expecting, you know, you're saying it's great, but it should really be a standard. It should be commonplace. It should be the things that everyone has access to and that we're considering become just part of the delivery we do in learning development or any type of comms or publishing or any of those things that we're doing. But as you said, I don't think it is. From my experience, it's very patchy. I also think there's not a lot of understanding of what good looks like. So I think there's not great examples out there. And I say that beyond this part of learning. I think there is a huge gap in terms of what good learning looks like. People are in their own bubbles and see and experience what they see. But actually seeing good practice across the industry, I think there's a huge gap. We go in and see in organizations all sorts of different practice, and people have no view as to what's really going on out in other organizations. So I think an ability for us to more openly share and set a standard or put up what we're doing and people contribute or comment in a collaborative way to help us improve. Because I think that's missing from our industry and certainly from this space as well, because I don't think there is really that best practice that we're all driving up. I think there's pockets of good practice you come across, and that's because there's probably someone very passionate or an organization. It doesn't tend to be that level playing field or norm that is what we're trying to do.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I used to deliver the what used to be called PETALS, it's now the level 3 award in education and training, and in that it always interested me some of the ways that we're training people to train, and things like VARC. So for those that aren't familiar with VARC, you've got visual, auditory, read, write and kinesthetic. And the idea is that we'd all have a preference for the way that we learn. Now, if you Google VARC or learning styles, you'll see that it's been debunked many times over. And it's the rigidity, I think, that comes with that, the teaching of learning styles, the teaching of VARC, that we should teach people to learn in a way that the idea behind it, I love. Let's teach people in a way that suits them. But the idea behind, well, this person is an auditory learner, so we can only talk to them, like, don't show them anything ever. We can only talk to this person or give them something to listen to. And this person's a visual learner, so, you know, don't talk to them, just give them a picture. Don't give them any words even, just a picture or a video. And you think about that as a basis, it's not a bad starting point, thinking about how can we have a multi-sensory learning environment? How can we make it so that we are covering different things? But it's just that rigidity. I remember another thing saying, I was teaching about classroom layouts, and you had to have a classroom layout that was the right thing for the type of training that you were doing. So it taught that a U shape was for this kind of training, whereas lines were for, you know, having people in rows was for this kind of training. And again, it's that kind of very fixed, this is how we will lay out a classroom, where actually, do you know, there might be some people in there that really, really like a U shape because they can see everybody. Sometimes there might be people who quite like to just be sat a little bit tucked out the way, a little bit up the corner, and find it a bit awkward to be sat in a U shape, because actually you end up, if the room's not quite big enough, you end up not being able to see the screen properly. Or I did some training recently where I kind of had to keep running backwards and forwards so that I wasn't blocking the screen for the people in this U shape. And I think it's that, it's the idea again that there is this black and white way in which we should train, you know, co-creating ground rules. Now, that's absolutely great, co-creating ground rules, if you've got a bunch of people in your room who want to come up with suggestions right at the beginning of the session and talk out loud about the things that are going to help them and the things that aren't. But actually, if you've just got one really loud person in that room that's happy to share, you haven't really co-created ground rules, have you? You've co-created it with one person, but not the group. And so perhaps the best practice is not going to be this nice utopian, do this, then do this. But the best practice is going to be consider this, think about this, bring this into it, invite people to share what helps them to learn. You know, I don't need to declare that I have ADHD to be able to tell you that I learn by talking things through. I learn by saying things out loud, and that I struggle to learn by listening for a long time. I can just say that, and that's okay. And maybe that's the shift that we need, is more around the social inclusive environment, you know, the cultural environment, not just physical environment, and just inviting people to be them in whatever way that feels right for them.
Yeah, going back to the point when you're talking about VARC, I just, it reminds me of the whole, we were talking about the boxes and the rigidity, and that humans aren't rigid and don't fit into boxes. And it comes back to, you know, you get this whole sort of polarized conversation of learning styles are complete rubbish. But as you said, they might have been debunked, but as a starting point for that sort of, you know, squidginess and the fact that everything doesn't sit in boxes, that having that ability to start. And there's the whole evidence-based practice piece that applies to learning. And there's part of me that's just goes, it can't be evidence-based practice because we're not all the same. You know, it doesn't really work. So to me, it's more evidence-informed practice. You're looking at this, but you have to have some element of nuance. You have to, you know, it's not one size fits all. It's not one, as you said, it's not, you know, a U-shaped cabaret or lines or whatever it happens to be for this type of environment, because sometimes the room doesn't lend itself that way. You have to be creative and make the most of what you've got. You've got different groups all the time. So that ability of having a starting point, but understanding some of the benefits of those things, and then understanding how to engage, as you said, your audience, whoever that might be, the group you're collaborating with, or however you view it, to build that in a way that isn't just the loudest mouth in the room dictating what you're doing. And I think there's sometimes we have this, and I seem to see more and more of it, it's these polarized views. And I don't think polarized views really help us to understand that most of the world is gray or any of those other colors we were talking about earlier. And how we get people into that space is really important. And I could talk about this whole debate about evidence-based practice and it pushing us apart. Whereas I think what you're talking about is bringing us together. And as you said, it's not about the label I bring. It's just about what works for me or what I might need at a particular time. And as you said, it might be different if on a hot day to a cold day. You know, again, we can't just say, this is Hayley's labels and that's what we must do with her on this day or forevermore. That's going to change and evolve. And humans are entirely complex things that do not fit into boxes. And I think where people view it in that really simplistic way, it really doesn't help in any way, shape or form.
No, I think you're right. And I think one of the things that we've not even touched on today is things like virtual learning experiences and e-learning and learning in the moment and those kinds of things as well. And I think I remember when we very first went into lockdown and everything turned to virtual, there was so much of trainers talking about how to make learners get their cameras on. You know, because we want to have, if we've got 20 people on a call, we want to have 20 cameras on, because how can somebody learn if their camera's not on? You wouldn't sit at home with a paper bag over your face, would you? You wouldn't sit in a classroom with a paper bag over your face. So why are you sitting at home with the camera off? And actually, you know, for many people, having the camera on is a really distracting element to that learning. It's going to actively stop them getting the best out of their day. So again, just that openness to my experience is not your experience. And just because, so for me, the majority of the time having my camera on is a really good thing. It helps me to stay focused. It helps me to, gives me a bit of accountability. It stops me wandering off, you know, like it's a helpful thing for me to have that camera on. That doesn't mean that that's the same for everybody. And what we need to do is really respect people and make our learning engaging enough that they want to be there, rather than having something that's that
forced dull attendance. Attendance that doesn't add any value. Yeah, like you said, exactly. Make people want to be there, feel that they're getting something valuable from it, feel that they want to participate in whatever participation way is working for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I don't know what the technical word for it is, you might. I did a marketing course a while ago, and it talked about having the personas of your ideal clients. And so it said, you know, consider, and this is creating boxes, so consider having, say, 5 personas of clients. And I think that's a really interesting viewpoint to take when you're thinking about learning. And actually, we could use some stereotypes to help us think about the inclusivity of our learning. What we could do is we could say, right, okay, if I'm thinking about, let's just, so there's a whole raft of intersectionality when we come into inclusion. Now we're going to be really selfish. We're going to just talk about neurodiversity, because otherwise we'd be here for 3 weeks on a podcast, which that's some listening, isn't it? So if we just talk about neurodiversity in our personas, and say we choose 5 personas, and we could have somebody with ADHD that's going to struggle to concentrate for long periods of time. We could have somebody with autism who, as an example, and like I say, this is me stereotyping, this is not me summing up every condition as a black and white entity. We could have somebody with autism who doesn't like to get involved in group discussions. We could have somebody with dyslexia who's going to struggle to read your slides, and we could have somebody with dysgraphia who's going to struggle to write any notes. We need one more. Let's have somebody who actually we believe is neurotypical, so they don't struggle with any of these things and don't have any understanding of any of these things either. Bit of ignorance, perhaps. Now, if we were thinking now about these 5 people, and what would our, if we've designed a course, whatever that course is, whether it's e-learning, whether it's virtual, whether it's face-to-face, whether it's a long program, and we would consider those learners at each step of the way throughout our course, what challenges are they going to face? What's going to excite them? What's going to work really well for them? What's going to be really hard for them? What additional information might they need? What additional permissions might they need? You know, they might need the permission that says you don't have to have your camera on. If that doesn't work for you, please don't worry about putting it on. That's okay. They might need the permission. I had somebody the other day that sat in a training course with their shoes off. They kind of needed the permission to be however was going to be right for them. And literally within 30 seconds of me saying that, they took their shoes off. They were like, oh, it's so much nicer to sit with my shoes off. There might be somebody who needs a bit of support if we're going to ask them to do group work, if we're going to ask them to dive into conversations. It might be somebody who, you know, we like to do that thing as trainers where we're like, oh, I'm going to mix you all up, all of you, mix you all up into new groups, because that's the best way to have a good conversation. For some people, that's wonderful. For other people, that just means that they're going to spend 70% of that breakout activity getting comfortable with the fact that they're with somebody brand new. And then the last little bit is going to be focused on what they're doing. And so, you know, it's not to say that you can never do it, but it's to say, think about what you're doing. Think about the implications. Think about, actually, why do we need to mix people up that much? You know, what does it actually give us? And are there ways we could do it? Could we split just half of that group each time? And so by the end of the day, everybody's worked with everybody, but actually each time you go into an activity, you're still with somebody that you were with last time, at least one or two people. It's just another way of doing it. And so using those kind of avatars or those personas and thinking about, if I were to have this person, this person and this person, what would be really naff about my training and what would fly really well? And what can I do to mitigate that naffness? How can I make that better for everybody? And you know what? The majority of the time, thinking about this is going to make it better for everybody. You know, this, it's not just, I remember challenging somebody. We had some training that was like a 100-page PowerPoint slide that somebody was reading out. That was all they were doing, just reading out 100 slides, and it was awful. And I kind of said, you know, like, I have ADHD and I'm just not absorbing anything you've said. In fact, what I'm currently doing is concentrating on not leaving the room. That's all that my brain is doing right now. It's just concentrating on not leaving this room. And so I'm not getting anything out of it. And so they went away and they redesigned this training. I wasn't quite so blunt, by the way. But they went away, they redesigned the training, and then they redelivered it. And actually, consistently, their feedback was so much better. Because nobody wants to sit in a, there might be some people that are able to absorb that. But, and I guess maybe there's a very small percentage of people that do enjoy it, but I would say it's a small percentage. But the majority of people are not going to get a lot out of that. So we talk about in the world of neurodiversity and inclusion, we talk about the canary in the mine. You know, we had canaries in mines that were there to show the miners when the gas level was no longer safe. And it'd show them before it got to the point of the miners becoming ill or dying. And they were very sacrificial canaries, right? But actually, in your learning environments, unfortunately, potentially your neurodivergent colleagues in that or delegates in that environment are going to be the canaries. So don't see them as the troublemakers. Don't see them as the awkward ones. See them as the ones that it's well worth listening to, because they're going to be the ones that can front this out first of all and make sure that that's a better environment for everybody.
I love that analogy. I think it's so true that, you know, that like it's like an early warning system of this isn't quite right. No one should have the 100 slides. The fact anyone has ever done that, or I hope no one is still doing that, but they are, because the 100 slides has become the click, click, clicky learning course that was 100 slides that is now 500 clicks and some, you know, I need to watch an animation that longs out me taking in some information because I don't trust the information. You know, there's all sorts of design issues within all sorts of formats of learning that maybe if we step back and look at with a more diverse group of stakeholders to say, how can we make this better? And I think you're right, that'll make it better for more and more people, including the 80%, because they will be, as you said, some of those are not yet aware of, or whatever you're talking about. So it's that journey is really important. Now, we've talked about lots and lots of things, Hayley, and we could probably go on for the rest of the day. But as you said, no one wants to listen to a 3-week or whole day podcast. So what are your hopes for the future? What would you like to see change and evolve?
I mean, there's that utopian moment where there's no longer a place in the world for people doing the job that I'm doing. Wouldn't that be awesome? Where we've reached such a point of inclusion that nobody needs to go and deliver the training on how to be inclusive. That's genuinely a hope, much as, you know, somebody, when that happens, please employ me because I'm not quite sure what I'll do next. But much as that's a bizarre thing to wish for oneself, I kind of do hope that we reach that point. That really is what I'd like to get to. I'd like to get to a point where every single individual has the space to be themselves, to bring their best self, and to enjoy what they do, whatever that may be.
Fabulous. And what next for you?
I mean, I tend to plan about 3 weeks in advance. Sorry, 3 days in advance. So I can tell you what I'm doing for the next 3 days. In terms of what next long term, I don't know. I just continue to explore the journey, meet fabulous people, work with wonderful organisations, and I guess just continuing with supporting people to understand themselves, to understand each other, and to just get the best out of life.
And I really like to thank you for joining us today. I really enjoyed the conversation myself. If people want to get in touch with you, continue the conversation, they've been inspired by what you said, they want to employ you or, you know, contract you in to deliver something, how's the best way of them getting in touch with you?
So I am on LinkedIn, Hayley Brackley, and I've got a little 100 emoji in front of my name. You can find me there. You can also have a look at my website, which is www.greatmindsdon't.co.uk. And that's my company name, which is Great Minds Don't Always Think Alike. Because how long have we been told that they do? Actually, I'd like to debunk that. Or you can pop me an email, Hayley, H-A-Y-L-E-Y, at greatmindsdon't.co.uk.
That's fabulous. And we'll make sure all of those links are in the show notes below. Hayley, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, James.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Learning Reinvented podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you've not already done so, please follow our podcast. And if The Learning Effect can help you and your organisation, please do get in touch. You can find both James and Katie on LinkedIn, and our contact details are in the show notes below.